You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brent Simpson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Sandy Jones on the show with me today. She has an amazing new-ish book. It's called The Half Sister. You may also know her other book that made quite a splash a year or so ago called The Other Woman. I love your book, Sandy, and I'm so happy to have you on the show. Welcome.
Hi, Hank. Thank you very much. I'm good to be here.
Well, it's good to have you. We were just laughing and having a great time because of some technology gremlins that got in the way, but we have vanquished them and we are ready to talk about books today. Sandy, we begin each show with the same question, and mm-hmm. that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, goodness. I would imagine, although it's not a conscious memory, but I would imagine it goes back to when I was 8 or 9. And we had a library truck, kind of a mobile library truck, come round once a week. And I think it was on a Wednesday or Thursday. It was definitely midweek sometime. And I was always, English was the only subject I was any good at, English language. And it continued to be throughout my entire school life, actually. I just remember, I very distinctly remember sitting in this, and it was kind of a glorified camper van, if you like.
Sure.
And it just kind of come around and sort of stop at the end of my road. And it was just the excitement of what this truck had, you know, the stories that it held and the magic that it had within it. It's hard to describe, but I think that was probably the moment, and just knowing the hours that I wasn't allowed to spend hours in there because it was very much a mobile library that kind of had to keep moving, as it were. But I think that was probably the time that it never occurred to me that I could do the same and I could be a storyteller, but it certainly, and certainly not do it for a living. But that was certainly the moment or the memory that I can recall, that just what a fabulous, magical thing it must be to be a storyteller.
You know, Sandy, I know exactly that feeling that you're talking about, knowing that van is full of stories, and you have really no idea what they are, but you just know that it's brimming with them. And it, as trite and as cliche as this may sound, I still get that same feeling, you know, in my late 40s, as that you're talking about, you know, when I do one of these author interviews, and I know that there's something there that I'm going to discover that I'm going to absolutely love. Or, you know, when I take a trip to the bookstore, and there's just this, books can give you that sort of feeling that you never have to outgrow. It's one of the few things in life that you can have that same childlike, not childish, but childlike kind of giddiness over, and judges you for it.
That's very true. And also, I think it's, and libraries, like you, Hank, libraries and bookshops still do that to me. And I just love just the idea that you can go in there, whatever mood you might be in, or whatever, you know, whatever you might fancy, there'll be something in there that ticks that box. And I just find that so exciting. I just, you know, that anything, there could be, you know, the stories that are within those pages, within those books, can just tick any box that you need it to tick. You know, you just kind of have to go, obviously, to the right genre or whatever. You know, whatever you're feeling, you've got something there to satisfy you. And I just think that's so exciting, like you, even now.
So, Sandy, you said that English was your best subject and the thing that you connected with. But like most of us, I think, was there some sort of trepidation or some sort of feeling that that even though this was something that connected with you so deeply and so strongly, there was a disconnect. It felt like that maybe this was an unattainable thing. Like, what was that realization for you?
Yeah,
when you realized that this was something you could do.
It was totally unattainable as far as I was concerned. I mean, even up until 3 years ago, to be honest, I've been writing as a journalist for sort of 20, 25 years now. And that was something that when I started, I couldn't quite believe that I was getting paid to write. And I certainly think when not the idea of a book came to me, but it's just something that I was just tinkering with. I really had no expectations at all. I really wasn't intending. I don't even think I was intending to write a book. I just wanted to see how it went. It was just something I felt that I had to do for myself, just to, again, tick that box to say, okay, Sandy, you've given it a go. It was an absolute disaster. It failed on an epic level, but you've done it and you can kind of, that's on your bucket list. You can tick it off now and you've written a book. And I think because of that and how I felt, I didn't tell anybody at all, including my husband and my children. They had no idea I was writing a book. And it took me about 4 or 5 months just to kind of get it into some kind of shape. And I honestly thought I was going to just put it in a drawer and just say I'd done it. And I just got to the end of it, Hank, and I thought, what have I got to lose? If I'm not expecting anything, and I can't be too disappointed by rejection, what really have I got to lose? So I mapped out my top five agents in the UK, who again were just so off the scale, amazing, unattainable, up there agents. I thought, well, no, again, let's start at the top, because then I just work my way down through the list if that's the way I felt. And three of them requested the manuscript immediately, the full manuscript immediately. Literally that same afternoon I sent it. And I kind of began to get a little bit of a fizz going on, thinking, oh, hang on a minute here. This might have legs. But it really, really wasn't until that point that I even imagined being a published author. It just wasn't on. It was on my dream list, but it just wasn't on the attainable list as far as I was concerned. So, to see how it's now gone in the last sort of 2 years or so, it's incredible. A dream come true and totally unexpected.
Well, Sandy, you mentioned your time working as a journalist, and you've done many, many interviews with people over 25 years or so that you mentioned. I love to talk to journalists, and I know quite a few that spent a good bit of time in journalism and then turned to writing fiction. There's something about reading a great piece of journalism where you know that this person that you're reading has witnessed an event or maybe talked with a person and have seen this story. I'm using air quotes here with my fingers. The same story that 100 people saw, but reading her account of it is completely different, because a good journalist have a knack for finding that little something that everyone else missed, or being able to hone in on this particular detail that makes the story come alive. Mm-hmm. As a fiction writer now, do you look at your time in journalism, and can you put your finger on some tools that you picked up, some skills that you learned from journalism that make you a better fiction writer?
I think I was always able to kind of very easily see the top line in every story, and I could quite easily get to the crux of the story. And I'd like to think that I'm a very good listener, more so than probably a good writer, because I do believe genuinely that to interview and to write a piece, it's actually all about the listening rather than the writing itself. However, you know, I did sort of specialize in celebrity interviews, and I think, again, I mean, the stories that, you know, these were one-to-one, always one-to-one interviews. I'm not kind of, you know, the hack that kind of goes down celebrities' dustbins or anything like that to get a gem. They've always been sort of face-to-face, one-to-one interviews. And I've just loved getting, you know, I suppose it's probably every journalist, something that's in every journalist, but it's just finding that, even with a celebrity, it's finding that just that little nugget that they've perhaps not talked about before, or that you can kind of develop. That was kind of the rewarding part for me, as far as interviewing is concerned, and finding that story. But also, I think from a negative point of view, as far as fiction writing goes, I think I probably held off writing fiction a lot longer than I would have done, because I think obviously when you're interviewing somebody, regardless of whether they're a celebrity or not, you know, you have to report their words verbatim. You have to, everything has to be done in their own words. You know, you can't add any sort of frills or fancy bits. You can't, you know, you have to be very, very careful and very, you know, it's very restrictive writing in that sense. So to then sort of turn it to fiction, I didn't think I was going to be any good at it at all. I've always felt that I would be so restrictive in my writing that I wouldn't be able to kind of let go and let my imagination run riot. But certainly with the other woman, that surprised me hugely, because once I unlocked the lion from that cage, that just kept going and going and going. And what started as almost a comedic piece about a mother-in-law's relationship with her daughter-in-law turned into a very sort of dark, sinister yes. story that I don't understand where that comes from or how I do that, to be honest. It swings and roundabouts, I think, from a journalistic to a creative writing point of view, and I think advantages and disadvantages, to be honest, Hank.
Papyrus Author was designed and developed with the modern writer's needs, wishes, and preferences in mind. From big structures right down to tiny details, every single feature of our software has been carefully and meticulously crafted in collaboration with authors. Take charge of your writing with the author interface, which gives you access to different elements of your story, such as characters, backgrounds, and narrative structure. Move sections of your writing seamlessly in the navigator and evaluate the complexity of your text with our expert style and readability analysis. Never worry about losing progress with automated backups. With Papyrus Author, you can be your own writer, editor, and publisher. The world of writing is about to change. Papyrus Author, the word processor for authors, has arrived on the international stage. Unrivaled in its scope, it is the first software suite to unite every single step of creative writing. The vision behind Papyrus Author is to empower everyone with an idea to turn it into a great book for free. A word processing core that matured for over 10 years at its foundation, Papyrus Author goes beyond the text with its intuitive organizing layers for story, characters, notes, and research. The powerful style and readability analysis help raise manuscript quality. The inbuilt publication capabilities take the book directly to the reader with ebooks, DocX, and print-ready PDF. Visit papyrusauthor.com to get started today. Do you want to get paid to write stories? Do you enjoy collaborating with other talented storytellers? Do you want to work completely remotely and set your own hours? Relay Publishing is looking for writers and editors to work on fiction projects across a range of genres, from thrillers to sci-fi, fantasy, and romance. The Relay process is extremely collaborative, in the same vein as a TV show's writer's room. If you're a story geek then you'll be on a great team. There are 7 ghostwriting positions and 10 editing positions currently available. Please go to www.recruitment.relaypub.com. That's www.recruitment.relaypub.com for more information on how to apply. Join a great storytelling team today. Well, Sandy, I discovered the other woman several months ago. My oldest daughter got married this summer, just a couple of months ago. And let me tell you what, planning a COVID wedding is, I don't wish that on anyone.
How did that go?
Oh, you know, the venue changed. No lie, I think 6 times the venue changed. And we finally wound up just having an outdoor wedding and inviting family and a few close friends and just everybody being outside. And it was not what we planned, but regardless, so finding a book like The Other Woman while we're preparing for my daughter to get married was kind of hilarious. And if folks have read that, they'll know what we're talking about. You know, what fascinates me about thriller writers, especially, and I know a ton, and we've gotten to know lots of authors, is that mystery writers, thriller writers, horror writers are some of the nicest, kindest people that you'd ever meet. And you're like, how can you where did you dream up this story? Yeah. Do you remember what the first kernel of an idea for this book was? And you mentioned just a second ago that it almost started as like a joke with you. Is that kind of where the story came from?
Absolutely. It was a conversation between me and some friends. And it really was that kind of, and I don't know whether you kind of had it over there, Hank, but to this degree, but, you know, so in the 70s and 80s, we had comedians here, you know, stand-up comedians here, and the joke would always be on the mother-in-law, you know, and,
right. Sure.
And you know, it'd be on the variety shows, and it was a really big kind of thread. And I think, you know, talking to girlfriends, it was them just sort of, and thank, I mean, my mother-in-law is no longer with us, but thankfully she was a wonderful woman. But, you know, the relationships that my girlfriends have, some of my girlfriends have with their mother-in-laws is really quite just very, very difficult, very difficult. And what I think what it kind of came down to is that, you know, the same women that I've been speaking to over the last sort of 20, 25 years or so about the relationship they share with their difficult mother-in-law, you know, they're now having, or they've now got children of their own who are kind of starting to bring the girlfriends home, and they're kind of repeating the same kind of behavior with, you know, with their children's partners. And I just thought it was a really interesting setup. But as I say, mostly we laughed about it and it was a joke thing. And there were a couple of instances, one in particular I wrote in the book about where my friend was, you know, the mother-in-law kind of got a group photo sort of set up, and she was getting everybody into place and everybody into position for them, the whole family. And then she turned to my friend, her daughter-in-law, and just said, you know, well, okay, can you take the photo, please? And that was an actual true, that was a very true story.
Oh,
and
it
was,
wow.
Yeah, it was little nuggets like that, again, that kind of just sort of started kind of clicking in my mind. And I thought, okay, this could be really quite funny. And, you know, we could have a little bit of a laugh with this. But as I say, the maybe not even 3 chapters in, Hank, I think, it just started going very dark. And I just found that each chapter I was kind of leaving it on a little bit of a cliffhanger. And I thought, oh, this isn't funny anymore. This is getting a little bit serious. And then I started doing a little bit more research into that side of these, you know, these tense relationships. And it's a big deal, and it's a big problem, you know, particularly between a woman and her mother-in-law. I think sure. Still it remains that, you know, in the norm, a man and his mother-in-law, it's still a bit of a jokey kind of situation. And they're kind of just sort of put up with, as it were. But I think it can get quite really quite unpleasant and very, very difficult. And also it puts a huge strain on marriages as well when the two women in a man's life aren't speaking the same language. So that's kind of where it kind of sort of started, stemmed from, as it were.
One thing that I love about your book, Sandy, The Other Woman and The Half-Sister, which I just finished, is you have this ability to create characters whom I feel like I know. And I feel like that they're just random people that I might meet, you know, going to the grocery store or going to the bank or whatever. They're just regular people. There's nothing necessarily that would make them stand out in a crowd. And yet there are these intense things happening in their lives. And I think that might be the most unsettling thing about it, is because, you know, how many people do we meet on a daily basis and there are these crazy things going on in their life that they can't talk about, and you shine a light right into, you know, these weird things that are happening to, you know, God forbid, some of the things that you write about don't happen to us, but they could be, and we just don't know. Are you the kind of person that likes to, you know, imagine people in your neighborhood or in your friend group and you know, these horrible things going on behind them? Do you daydream about
all the time? Yes, it's rather macabre, actually. What I've now discovered, Hank, is that I like to write about ordinary people who have extraordinary things happen to them. I think that's kind of it in a nutshell. I don't know that I could write necessarily about, you know, a serial killer or, you know, I'm not sure. I've not tried it. But I find it very easy, and it's very important for me, I think, for readers to be able to relate to the characters. And as you say, for it to be a possibility that any of this could happen to you or is possibly happening to your neighbor or someone you see on the school run, or, you know, I just love writing about ordinary people with these kind of crazy messed up lives that none of us really know about. And I guess it's that whole kind of what goes on behind closed doors, isn't it? It's
right.
That's where I'm comfortable writing at the moment. And I do think that, as I say, I do think that readers like to be able to relate to each of the characters and see perhaps something, a little something of themselves in them, or certainly someone they know. I mean, with Pammy and The Other Woman, I'd like to think, although this is not a very good thing to say, actually, but I'd like to think that everybody knows somebody like Pammy. you know, then I think there must be a Pammy, and even in the sort of distant kind of, you know, a friend of a friend's mother or something like that. I think there's a Pammy out there in everyone's life somewhere along the line.
Yeah, I think you're right. You mentioned that with The Other Woman, that, as you know, when you got about three chapters in, things turned dark, and then you kept writing and the story got sort of crazier as it went. Do you consider yourself to be more of a pantser than a plotter? It seems like the writing of this book was kind of one experience, but then as you followed that book up with now The Half-Sisters, and I know that you're working on other things now, has your writing process evolved, changed, or are you kind of that person with a flashlight that's looking on a dark path for what comes next?
I think it's had to, Hank, to be honest, because I think, you know, with the first book, anybody's first book, you have total freedom. Sure. To you know, even down to the point of, you know, deciding which genre you're going to write in. And I think once that first book's out, and obviously, you know, goodness, I mean, thankfully you get I got a publishing deal. I think once the first book's out, you know, things do change, and I think they have to, because obviously editors come on board, and you know, you all of a sudden have a reader that expects a certain something from a particular author each time. So I think certainly writing between the first and the second book was quite a steep learning curve, because I just, you know, as well as with editors as well, they, for the second book, they want everything up front. They want to know, and quite rightly, they want to know the story up front. They want to know who's in it, who does what to who, who's the villain, who isn't, you know, it's, and I haven't got that brain. I don't, my mind doesn't work like that. I think, as I found, I am definitely a plodder rather than a plotter. I don't, I just write, and it all comes as I write and as I go along. So to kind of offer up a 3-page synopsis, as it were, before I even start writing anything, sort of detailing what's going to happen and how it's going to happen. And I find that really difficult. In fact, I find that the hardest part of this whole writing process, actually. It's just incredibly, it's that 3-page synopsis over 100,000 words. The 100,000 is a piece of cake compared to the, right, the 3-page synopsis, because I just, it's, and I think my mind's had to change and work slightly differently to allow for that, because, you know, obviously publishers need to know what's coming. You know, we're working almost a year in advance. They need covers, they need titles, they need, you know, before even pens put to paper, as it were, they need to sell it into the bookshops, you know, this time next year. So they have to have a very clear idea a lot of the time before you even start writing what it's going to be about. So that to me has been a very steep learning curve, and I think that I'll continue to learn from that, because it, you know, it, even with the second book, the first mistake, it didn't hit the, you know, the goal didn't go in the net, as it were, the first time round. So it was a very big, major rewrite to get it, you know, to where it needed to be. But they, to have editors on board who do what they do and know what they're doing is incredible. So I am very, very thankful for that. And the books are by far all the better for it, that's for sure.
We talk a lot on the show about the gift of anonymity, and the, you know, when you're writing that first book, and the joy and the unfettered freedom that comes with no one knowing that you're writing a book, you know, maybe your spouse, maybe some family members, but no one's expecting anything out of you. There's surely not, you know, publishers out there breathing down your neck, because this is fun. This is a hobby. This is, you know, this is something that you're doing for personal fulfillment. And then when that book sells, and then, you know, becomes a Reese Witherspoon, you know, book club pick, and all that, all of a sudden it's a business now. And the thing you were doing for fun is now, okay, now people are expecting me to produce, and, you know, to bring about something that's going to, you know, pull the rug out from under them all over again. And I've talked to several authors who have wrestled with that, losing the joy that they got when they were writing for the fun of it, and now, you know, are expected to produce, and we're talking about problems that a lot of people would love to have. So let's don't skew it here. You know, this is a good problem to have. Mm-hmm. But are there things that you do to keep that joy of writing, even when you know that this is, you know, that there are schedules and deadlines and all that? Are there things that you do to connect with the story the way that you did when no one knew you were doing it?
That's a very good question, actually. Interestingly, I don't actually feel under too much pressure. I think mostly because I do write very quickly. So I'm not banging up against a deadline. You know, I'm not spending a lot of my year banging up against this kind of impending deadline. I have to say I haven't lost any of the joy of it at all. I think my only real moments are when perhaps I kind of get my first edits back, and you kind of read through the pages of edits, and you know, I think that's probably my only moment in each book's process where I think I can't do this. I can't undo that and make that make sense. And I can't, you know, it, and And it's the whole, it's the knock-on of effect of a suggestion kind of on page four, for example, that then obviously has to have a knock-on effect all the way through the book. And I think that's the only time, and that it's a 24-hour period where I just think I can't do this. I'm out of my depth, and this is just not going to work. But I think, as again, I'm sure all authors feel, you work through that. You sit with it for a little while, and you think about it, and it does all come to you. You know, it does. From somewhere, somehow, it does all happen and it does all click into place. And I'm actually a lot better when I'm really not thinking about it. It kind of catches me unawares, you know, the changes that I need to make or new ideas or anything like that normally kind of catch me unawares when I'm least likely to be focusing on it. And I think I've tried to force it a lot, or a few times I've tried to kind of, when I've got these edits back, I've just kind of sort of sat here with pen and paper open, just looking at it for hours, and it's still blank. I've definitely found that I get a lot more joy from the process, just to kind of carry on, go about my normal everyday life, you know, take a walk, you know, go out and just, I definitely am getting the solutions to any problems when I'm least expecting it and without forcing it. And I think that's a very big part for a lot of authors. And I know a lot of authors who can sit there and by the end of the day have a notebook full of ideas and things, and, you know, have these wonderful whiteboards where it's all kind of post-it notes, all color-coded. But that just doesn't work for me. I wish it did, I think, because I think it would be a bit easier. But that just doesn't work for me. So I really do go with the flow, Hank, to be honest. And I really haven't, apart from that little 24-hour period, I really haven't lost any joy for it at all.
I love it. So when you have a book that's a smash debut, like The Other Woman, and, you know, sells oodles of copies and everyone loves you, and then at some point in that process, you start thinking of the next book. With the Half Sister, a great story about regular people who are living their regular lives and then something extraordinary happens to them. Where did the idea for the story come from?
This was the Half Sister had a very, very strong starting point, actually, because I was reading about the Golden State Killer and about that, just an incredible case of, or the possibility of something happening, you know, 40, 50 years ago, and whereby he left his DNA almost at every single, you know, every single crime scene, and only now, sort of what, 18 months ago or so, that he's traced through a genealogy. His DNA is obviously, or is input into a genealogy website, and is tracked back to a distant relative, who then, you know, they're able to trace his family tree. And I was completely fascinated by that. I just thought it was just an incredible, I mean, what progress we've made. And I don't even know actually, Hank, what the situation is over there now. I mean, do you guys, with this whole uploading, or certainly the law enforcement uploading a suspect's DNA onto a genealogy website, is that sort of still legal? Or is it, I know it was frowned upon certainly by some when it happened, but I mean, is that kind of moving through a process now over there?
Yeah, I think so. It's definitely not front of mind right now. I know what you're talking about, but it's kind of off everyone's radar at the moment.
Right. Yeah. I think, I mean, obviously if that's the way that the law enforcement are allowed to go, I think that'd be fantastic, because, I read this case and I just thought about the possibilities of just transferring that. As I say, I don't really consider myself a crime writer, as it were. I think I'm definitely sort of in the domestic suspense genre. And I think that's now what people have probably come to expect of me. And I just wanted to see if I could apply that same, without kind of layering in all the science of it. I just wanted to see if I could apply that sort of science into a domestic setting, which is what I hope I've I've achieved with the half sister, because that's basically all what happens is that, you know, it's obviously about two sisters who on the face of it are kind of leading, you know, have a perfect relationship, I guess. But if you dig a little bit further, you'll see it's sort of really built on jealousy and resentment. And when another woman turns up claiming to be their half sister, it clearly sends the family into sort of a spiral of secrets and lies. You know, is she really who she says she is? Whose child is she? Who knew? You know, and why have they kept it a secret for all these years? And I just think, you know, the proof is literally there in the DNA, and you can't argue with that. And I still think it's absolutely fascinating.
Absolutely. The book came out a couple of months ago, but as we know, and we talked a little bit about this before we started recording, the COVID has changed a lot of people's plans and affected the way we buy books and the way we read books and all that. What's it been like for you to launch a book in the middle of this? And how are you, you know, talking to people about the book other than, you know, doing podcasts like this where we're talking about it? What other things are available to authors now to get the word out and to build excitement?
Yeah, it's very difficult, Hank. And also for me as a UK-based writer, it's very different. The UK, you know, have different kind of very different marketing tools and ideas compared to you guys. I will do sort of as much as I can, obviously virtually, and, you know, we've done kind of certainly St. Martin set up a very interesting author experiment a couple of months ago where six of us got on live, and we all had to kind of, one of us started a story, a thriller, and the sixth person obviously had to end it. All live for everybody to see, and it was terrifying to be honest. But I thought, no, if this is what we authors now need to do to kind of get ourselves out there and kind of get our books noticed, we just have to kind of move the goalposts a little bit each time, don't we? Just to adapt to this changing situation. But it is difficult. I don't think I would have wanted to delay publication, because I think kind of come sort of September time, when probably it would have been moved to if it was, you know, again, the market's been hit by such a huge number of delayed books that were moved to September. And it feels a lot more competitive than it did last year. And I just hope that people and readers have got the avenues whereby they can still purchase books and they can still read.
So Sandy, a while back, I started listening to audiobooks several years ago, but as time has gone on, my audiobook listening has gotten to be, more of my reading is done at listening to audiobooks now. And both of your books, The Half Sister and The Other Woman, I listened to both of those, the audiobooks first. There have been a number of books that I've read and then gone back and listened to the audiobook and then enjoyed it again, you know, with a little different perspective. I'm discovering more and more books as audio first now. And your books are a couple of those. Do you think about that this is going to be read aloud by someone and it's going to be enjoyed by readers in this way? Is it anything that crosses your mind during the writing? Because, you know, audiobooks are the largest growth market right now in publishing. Is that something that you think about at all? Or does that change anything about your creative process?
To be honest, Hank, no. I'm becoming more aware of it. But certainly when I wrote The Other Woman, that just wasn't even... Just to get it published in print would have been a dream come true. You know,
sure.
You just don't, I don't suppose you kind of think ahead in terms of audio and that kind of thing. But I did go along to, you know, the publishers were very kind to offer me sort of a few audio or narrators to choose from. And that whole process was quite surreal. I went along to the recordings of it I think that was really the first time where I just thought this you know, goodness me, this is really happening, because all of a sudden you're hearing somebody else bring your characters to life. And I felt embarrassed at times. There were some lines I thought, oh my goodness. And then I kind of get very emotional about it. And then that process thankfully has continued. And I mean, I'd like to ask you, how do you find, obviously, all of my books being narrated with a British accent, how do you find that to listen to as an audiobook listener?
I love it. And it's one of those things that you might think about it for the first couple of minutes. This narrator has a British accent, and then you just stop thinking about it. It just becomes the story that you're just involved in. It's kind of a weird. I've never actually thought about that until you just mentioned that. Like, okay. does the accent does it affect this? Not really. Okay. Now that you mentioned it.
Yeah, I just wondered, because obviously they are doing so well in the US. I just wondered from your perspective, whether you would prefer, obviously it's set in England, in London, but would it kind of then jar you a little bit, perhaps, if it was then narrated in an American accent?
Oh, for sure.
Oh, it would. Okay.
Yeah, especially in The Other Woman, there's so many. So many little Englishisms. It definitely takes place in a certain neighborhood. You know, it has this sort of feel, and there are lots of little references. And if someone with an American accent would have just thrown around those references like you do, it would have been off-putting, I think.
Okay.
But because it's in a British accent, it just my brain just goes along with it. Of course, that's, you know, where it is and what's going on. I don't know, but to me, it's not even something I think about.
Great. Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah. Well, the new book is The Half Sister. It's phenomenal. I know you guys are going to love it. I'm going to put links to it in the show notes of this episode to make it easy for you to find. Sandy, if people are just discovering you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, where can they find you online?
They can find me on sandyjones.com.
Excellent.
There's everything you need to see and know about on there. There's contacts, and I'm also on Instagram and on Twitter as well. So yes, please seek me out.
Absolutely. And we'll put links to make it easy for folks to find you. Sandy, this has been so much fun talking. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thanks so much, Hank.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new, easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web.
Do you ever wonder if a person's critical thinking comes at the expense of their own happiness? Is it possible to be very happy and still practice excellent discernment? I used to wonder the same thing. Then I discovered the Trouble in Paradise podcast with Nigel Kent and Jasmine Starr, where they laugh as well as think about conspiracy theories and unexplained phenomena without ever getting bogged down in the age-old tug-of-war between logic and feeling. The Trouble in Paradise podcast is a joyful program for critical thinkers who have a sense of humor. Join Nigel and Jasmine as they probe the intriguing and wacky culture of odd occurrences, strange news, and ridiculous coincidences on this hilariously intelligent podcast. Trouble in Paradise on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Stitcher. Follow at Tipcast239 on Twitter. Trouble in Paradise with Nigel Kinn and Jasmine Starr. A happy podcast for critical thinkers like you.